Now, over the last month, at least six states have signed into law bills adding new abortion restrictions. Not all of them have gone into immediate effect, with some legal challenges pending. But it continues a trend that started with controversial laws in Mississippi and Texas that served as the framework for the states that followed. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule this summer on the Mississippi law that bans most abortions after 15 weeks. That ruling could shape how Roe v. Wade is interpreted and set the precedent for other states passing similar laws. We're catching up on recent legislation and checking in on the status of abortion access in the United States. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about new abortion laws in other states? Do you think states should be able to regulate abortions at the state level, or should it be a federal decision? Do you want the Supreme Court to decide? What do you want them to decide? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Michelle Oberman is the Catherine and George Alexander Professor of Law at Santa Clara University. She's the author of the book Her Body, Our Laws, on the front lines of the abortion war from El Salvador to Oklahoma. Michelle, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Before we get into some of the specific laws and specific states, why are we seeing so many states tackle this issue right now?
Well, I think that's part of a long-term strategy that anti-abortion advocates have really been elaborating over the course of the past 50 years. And all of it is coming to a head now that there are five or perhaps even six reliable conservative votes on the Supreme Court. So there's a sense that these laws that historically have been passed in we'll call them red states, but not allowed to go into effect, might actually be allowed to go into effect if the court decides, as it's expected to do, that it's going to return the right to control abortion laws to the states.
Let's look at that case in the Supreme Court now, the one you just referenced, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, challenging the constitutionality of Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban. What is the court weighing in that decision? What is the range of decisions that they could make from, I guess, getting rid of Roe versus Wade altogether or a more narrow ruling?
Yeah. So actually, since 1992, the standard for state laws that would restrict abortion is that states are required to keep abortion legal. And aren't allowed to pass laws that would place what's called an undue burden on a woman's ability to access abortion. And so historically, for example, we've seen laws that allow up to a 72-hour waiting period between the first request for an abortion and the actual procedure. We've seen laws that effectively restrict access by requiring doctors to have certain credentials or clinics to have certain credentials. We've seen laws around informed consent, all found to be constitutional because they don't put that heavy burden, the undue burden, on a woman's right to access abortion. The Mississippi law is noteworthy because it moves access back to a 15-week cutoff point, something that seemed pretty radical and at the time that it was passed, because it's a point that everybody agrees is prior to viability. But it's also a point at which most people know that they're pregnant, right? You've passed the first trimester, you've missed almost three periods. And so the thought is that certainly by 15 weeks, a person would know that they were pregnant. Of course, the vast majority of abortions occur in the first trimester, over 90%. The abortions that tend to occur later at 15 weeks or later tend to involve either fatal fetal anomalies or a mother whose life or health is at risk. So somebody who, say, discovers midway through a pregnancy that they have cancer, and in order to treat it, we are advised to terminate the pregnancy, right? So the Supreme Court, in looking at that Mississippi law, has three choices. The first is to say that it places an undue burden on the woman's health, right, or the woman's right to access abortion. The second would be to say it actually doesn't, right, that we could live with a 15-week ban because most people realize they're pregnant before then and can take actions. And then the third would be to say, actually, we're dispensing with the undue burden standard. We're overturning Roe versus Wade, and we're allowing states to decide whether or not to make abortion criminal. Right? And those who are watching, sort of the court watchers who are watching carefully, are of the mind that the Supreme Court seems likely to go with the third option, to say, you know what, fetuses have rights too, and we're going to return this whole issue to the states and let them decide when and whether to restrict abortion access.
We are talking about abortion laws, abortion restrictions passing in many states around the country. Michelle Oberman is with us, professor of law at Santa Clara University. You could join in with your questions about the kind of laws being passed, what you would like to see in place, whether you think Roe versus Wade should stay in place or if the Supreme Court should overturn it and throw things to the states. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Michelle, are we seeing stricter standards coming up in states than that 15-week timeline?
Absolutely. There's a there's really an exuberance to the anti-abortion forces at state legislative levels around the country. We're seeing laws passed that would make it a felony, punishable by a decade in prison to perform an abortion. We're seeing a lot of so-called 6-week or heartbeat abortion bans. We're seeing statutes that make it a felony to aid and assist a person seeking an abortion. So the Mississippi law is just sort of one of countless laws that are being floated or passed. Or passed and enacted with an eye to what the law in the state will be if and when the U.S. Supreme Court decides to overturn the standard of Roe and Casey.
We're seeing some states pass a trigger ban, so-called. Wyoming, the latest one, saying we have this ban. It's not in effect. We're not going to try to bring it into effect unless and until Roe versus Wade is overturned. Also, some states like Wisconsin have laws that never were overturned, technically, that might, and this is an argument here in the state, might come back into effect if Roe versus Wade is overturned. Can you talk about that trigger law approach?
Yeah, there's a number of states in the country that, in anticipation of Roe versus Wade someday falling, have had for a while laws on the books that will spring into effect as soon as Roe is struck down. I think it's going to be, from a lawyer's perspective, a really interesting time. There'll be a certain amount of chaos on the ground. What I mean by that is that nobody on either side is quite ready for it. So, for example, imagine that you're a doctor who treats breast cancer, and imagine that your patient has breast cancer and is pregnant, right? So you haven't thought at all about abortion. And for decades, the standard of care has been a certain form of chemotherapy that might be harmful to the fetus. And for decades, the standard of care would be to say, look, it's up to you if you want to end this pregnancy or if you want to postpone treatment. Those doctors are going to suddenly find themselves wondering whether this is in fact a life-threatening pregnancy and therefore qualifies for an exception and it's a legal abortion. They're going to wonder whether in simply advising the patient about her options facing a cancer that is life-threatening, perhaps, whether they can advise her to travel to a state where it's legal, right? I mean, it just the uncertainty around the simple idea of a trigger law is, it's almost overwhelming. I mean, that's a very specific little example, but there are so many other examples that I can call into view if we had hours. So, yes, there will be these trigger laws coming quickly into effect, and there'll be a sense of deep uncertainty at every level in terms of how to understand the risks that you're facing under the law and the options that you have in terms of both responding to other conditions, but also in terms of responding to an unwanted pregnancy.
We're talking to Santa Clara University law professor Michelle Oberman about abortion access, recent laws passed in states around the country, many passing restrictions, some giving more guarantees to abortion access. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you in favor of restrictions on access to abortion? What is your dividing line? Where do you draw the line? What do you agree with, not agree with, from what you've heard about some states around the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about new abortion laws around the U.S. A lot of states taking action now. Michelle Oberman stays with us, professor of law at Santa Clara University, author of the book Her Body, Our Laws on the Front Lines of the Abortion War from El Salvador to Oklahoma. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Scott is with us in Madison. Scott, hi.
Afternoon. One that I have had in my head is people continue to call a fetus an unborn child. Will that unborn child fall under child safety restraints in automobiles?
Scott, thanks for the call. Michelle, that's Scott getting into the possible unanticipated consequences of changing that definition.
Yeah, what's so interesting about that question, Scott, is that it actually points to a whole area of law that will be relevant if abortion is illegal, and that is, what is the legal status of the fetus, right? Does it become a child with rights as a child? And if so, then what happens to just say child abuse and neglect laws? What about a pregnant woman who's doing something that might be seen as potentially risky, eating sushi, having a drink, going for a jog, right? And if she's doing that, then does a person watching her have a duty to call in and report her, right? Does the father of the child suddenly have an obligation or the threat of legal liability for a failure to intervene? I mean, it sounds nutty. It sounds like a crazy law school hypothetical, but it's not, because we haven't yet determined what the scope of legal rights are for the fetus. And I mean, it's just one small example of some of the chaos that I think is to come legally as we sort through the implications of banning abortion. A state doesn't need to. A state could say, actually, fetus doesn't have the same rights as a child, but the woman doesn't have a right to end an unwanted pregnancy. And so I think you'll see states doing a variety of things. In El Salvador, where I did my field work for my book, the first line of the Constitution says a person is a human being from the moment of conception. And so they answer that question about rights literally before the fertilized egg implants in the wall of the uterus. And they just leave for another day questions about voting rights. Like, well, if it's a person, does it have the right to vote? Right. Taxation rights, and obligations, things like that.
Thanks for that call.
Good question, though.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Michelle, before we go back to our callers, I know you've written and thought about the impact of abortion restrictions, especially as we get closer to total bans, on women, on low-income women in particular. What kind of things do you watch for there?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because what I study and care most about is not the change in the law on the books, but the impact of the law on the ground. And what we know about abortion is that the biggest demand for abortion, sort of the most common reason people give for needing or wanting an abortion, is that they cannot afford a child. 75% of abortions, literally three out of every four abortions in this country, go to people who are poor or near poor. And abortion bans won't be colorblind, right? I mean, abortion's not colorblind. Abortion bans aren't colorblind. Abortion disproportionately impacts the lives of the poorest Americans, who are disproportionately Black and brown. Those poorest folks are the ones who are most likely to struggle with accessing abortion where it's illegal, whether it's by traveling to a state where it is legal, or whether it's by accessing abortion medicines online, which anybody with a debit card and enough education to discern which of the websites are valid, would find it very easy to access the drugs needed to end an unwanted pregnancy. But on the ground, access to abortion and the impact of the bans is going to vary according to class. So the biggest takeaway from our ban is not going to be a huge amount of deterrence in terms of abortion. It's going to be an uptick in the number of babies born into poverty. Like the poorest folks among us are going to be those who would have had abortions if it was legal. They're going to be the ones who aren't able to navigate how to get themselves to a place where it remains legal. They're going to have children, and already those families constitute the bulk of child poverty in this country, right? 38% of single mother families live below the poverty line. So abortion bans, you can't really think about them separately from thinking about poverty in this country.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Angela is with us in Green Bay. Angela, hi.
Hi. I'm so glad you guys mentioned that. I feel like our focus is always on whether or not the fetus is considered human, and it's just this back and forth. I just kind of feel like the focus should be more on the reasons why women have abortions in the first place, and maybe to come up with processes or something to just kind of help to counteract that, whether it's education, whatever it is, just to help with the situation, because I'm sure it's not like women are going out there and just having abortions willy-nilly. It's a huge decision, and it's something I'm sure a lot of women have to take their time at making that decision. It's something that's not taken lightly.
Angela, yeah. Thanks for the call. Michelle.
I love what you said, your observation, Angela. We've had a really stupid conversation, frankly, about abortion for the past 50 years. One that focuses on whether or not it should be legal, one that doesn't really have a comfortable answer, right? We're not agreeing on it. We haven't agreed for 50 years. We're not likely to agree. And we haven't asked, well, what do you do if you want people to have fewer abortions, right? And the answer then is actually pretty simple. I mean, we know from everything around the world and in this country that the biggest thing that we can do to deter abortion is to actually increase access to contraception, right? I mean, half of all unintended pregnancies end in abortion. When people have access to contraception, they have fewer abortions, right? But even if we're not able to get to agreement around that, I really believe that there are, you know, sort of people of goodwill on both sides of this abortion war who want to actually support poor people who would have their babies if they could afford them. And once we start to focus on what drives abortion, I think we start to see really clearly the situations that I think, you know, that are endemic in this country, right? The expectations that childbearing is a private choice and that children are private choices, not public goods. In countries with the lowest abortion rates around the world, what you see is subsidized daycare. You see guaranteed paid parental leave. You see tax subsidies. You see child allowances. You see excellent public school available locally in your neighborhood, right? And all of these things require a country that actually wants to encourage people to have babies. We don't live in that country, right? I mean, this is not a country that wants to encourage poor people to have kids. We don't like abortion, maybe, but we also don't like poor people having babies, apparently.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Rob is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Rob, hi.
Hi there. Just want to give you a backstory on myself. I, when I was 18, had an abortion. I also had worked in the OB as I got older, and I currently have two children of my own. If I wasn't allowed legal access to abortion when I was that young, I wouldn't be here. So just remember that.
Thanks for that call, Rob. Michelle, I think a lot of people with stories like that not always heard.
Yeah, thank you so much for the courage to share your story. I mean, I think we're moving into an era in which more of us will need that level of courage. We have to talk about the circumstances that surround these really difficult decisions because it's the only way forward.
Thanks again for calling in and sharing that. Michelle, in just our last minute and a half or so, what are obviously the U.S. Supreme Court decision, what are you watching for next as states continue to pursue various kinds of restrictions?
What I'm watching for is whether there's going to be a schism between people who are pro-life, meaning they really want babies to be born, and people who are anti-abortion, meaning they just want the laws to make abortion illegal, right? And that distinction hasn't mattered up until now because it was all legal anyways. But I think there's going to be a split. I think that folks who have supported abortion bans because they thought abortion would go away when it was banned are going to be deeply disappointed when they see that it actually continues, and that that schism might lead to a realignment where we can actually start to see policies that support the poorest and most vulnerable among us.
As you were saying earlier, you think that our debate has been stupid in many ways. Do you see it getting smarter in any way in the next, I don't know, 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm an eternal optimist that way. And I think putting a face, just like Robin did and just like Angela did just now, I mean, putting a face on the decisions that surround how people respond to an unwanted or an unplanned pregnancy, putting faces on that will really call upon us to have conversations about what we owe to folks who are affected by abortion bans and what we owe to folks who are facing an unwanted pregnancy that's unwanted because they can't afford a child, right? I mean, 60% of abortions go to people who already have children. So, I mean, I'm hopeful that we'll start to see a new alignment around a sense of moral obligation toward the most vulnerable among us.
Michelle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks to you.
Michelle Oberman is the Catherine and George Alexander Professor of Law at Santa Clara University. She's the author of the book Her Body, Our Laws on the Front Lines of the Abortion War from El Salvador to Oklahoma. She was with us today talking about the status of abortion access in the wake of new laws passed by several states across the country and a Supreme Court case in the works.